see where it is. It's there, underneath the water, which is coming over the top of it. Essentially what you've got is random destruction, and of course that can happen. You can get landslides and earthquakes in random places where no one ever expected them. They're good examples of that sort of thing. So there is a background to the suffering that we cause, lots of other suffering which we don't cause, at least not directly. But in the end, the biggest disaster that there is the fact that in the end death comes to everyone, and in the end we all have our disaster. When a tsunami happens, a lot of people die at once and it's a disaster, but think of it over a period of 200 years, everybody is going to die in that period. Well, not everybody, some people will only just have been born at the end of it, but nevertheless you get a huge numbers of death, and in the end we've all got our own disaster. We're all going to die, and at the end suffering and death are facts. The end of us will be the same, whether we die in a war or in a natural disaster or in our beds. So suffering and death are facts for it all. Now, atheists tend to use the existence of suffering as the basis for an argument for the non-existence of God. I looked at a number of websites put up by militant new atheists, and all of them contained the argument from suffering as their reason for not believing in God. And for most of them, it was the only argument they used for the non-existence of God. They had no other arguments. One or two of them had thought of something else, but they didn't amount to very much. And the argument goes something like this. It starts off with the idea that if you have an all-powerful God, that all-powerful God would have enough power to prevent suffering. And secondly, if you have a good God, then a good God would want to eliminate suffering, prevent suffering. But it's a matter of observation that the world is full of much suffering, and from that they deduce that there cannot be a God who is good and all-powerful. So therefore the atheists argue the Christian God doesn't exist. It's quite interesting, because they're very insistent on the Christian God. And it's often put in a very emotive way. I had the question thrown at me, where was God in Iraq? And the idea being that the deaths of tens of thousands of innocent civilians who had been killed there by terrorists since the Second Gulf War are suffering, and how can I account for the existence of God when that is going on? I also had a question a bit further back than that. How can you believe in a God who allows babies to be murdered? Again, it's a very, very emotive way, but it boils down to it. It's this argument. Now, it is a very emotionally loaded argument. What they're trying to do is to get people to revolt against the idea of God emotionally without thinking about it too much. But if we're going to understand the issue, then we have to keep a clear head and think logically about it. I'm going to start off there, because there are other questions involved, and we can come to those afterwards, which are more emotionally loaded. But let's think about the logical bit to start off with. Really, there are three questions that are coming up. There's the problem of evil. Why does God allow suffering in the world? There's the problem of justice. Why do the innocent and the guilty both suffer? Why not just the guilty? And the third problem is, practical one, what can I believe? What should I do? So, again, let's get to the logical one first. Why does God allow suffering in the world? So it's the problem of why a good and powerful God would allow the presence of suffering in the world. And, of course, that's the heart of the atheist argument. There's the atheist argument again. And there are two issues. First of all, is the idea of being all-powerful. An all-powerful God can do anything, but he can't be inconsistent. He can't contradict himself. If an all-powerful God gives mankind free will, then he has chosen not to control everything. He's given some things where he does not control the outcome. And the outcome of many things is a combination then of the free will of creatures that God has made and the intention of God. It's not just a matter of God choosing to do whatever he wants and doing anything he feels like. So God's actions with mankind depend to some extent on the response of human beings. Now there's another problem, I think it's probably even more important, which is the idea of a good God. And the definition that the atheists want to use is a good who will keep us content and happy no matter what we do. Doesn't matter, we can do anything we like, we can be as unpleasant as we want to other people, we can go murder or whatever, but God will still keep us happy. That's the idea of a good God in the atheist definition. Well, that isn't a good God at all, that's an indulgent God. And God is good, God is not indulgent, God is good. And think what really we would mean by a good God. Well, that could what God actually be like. Well, the starting point there is that there is a clear difference between right and wrong, between good and evil. And we all know this. Human beings have an acute appreciation of right and wrong, which remains the same across all cultures, across all nations, across all ages. There have been a whole load of recently of experiment done on small children getting barely able to speak, getting them to see what they think is good and what is bad, or on people from different cultures asking questions, going out in the Amazon jungles and asking questions about right and wrong. People who have only just emerged, have had no contact with civilization whatsoever for maybe thousands of years, or hundreds anyway, maybe not at all. And they all come up with the same answers. They all know the same things are right, they all know the same things are wrong, they all know there are some things where it's hard to make a decision between what's right and what's wrong. And they come up with the same answers in the same situations, or similar ones. So there is definitely a universal principle of right and wrong. And you can't derive that principle purely from logic. Lots of philosophers have tried to do that, but they've all failed. And it isn't a consequence of scientific theory. That people say, you can have a scientific theory of right and wrong. Well, you can't. Science is based on experiment. You can only start off with data you get from experiment. Well, I could do experiments. I could put some strychnine in the speaker's water, the president's water. And I'll ask him later if he'll let me do that one. And it will tell me what the effects are, and I can repeat that on other people, and we make observations, and we'll find out that it brings about death in a particular way. Doesn't matter how many experiments I do, none of them will tell me whether it is right or wrong to put strychnine in the president's water. Yeah, experiments can't tell you what's right and what's wrong. They can only tell you what happens. They can't tell you what ought to happen. And that's the problem. Science is very limited. It can tell you what has happened and what is happening, tell you what is there. It cannot tell you what ought to happen. And you can't derive an ought from an is. So there's no way, no scientific theory that can tell you what is right and what is wrong. And some people say, well, it's evolved. We've evolved to have a sense of right and wrong. Well, evolution is a scientific theory, and a scientific theory can't generate a difference between right and wrong. We've just seen that. So whether it's true or false, for another lecture, it can't give you what is right and what is wrong. Evolution can't do that. So there's a general moral principle. There you are. There's something in from the New Testament which summarizes this, the principle of what is right and what is wrong, down to a very small number of words, but there's no idea of right and wrong unless there is something outside the system that defines the difference between right and wrong. And a Christian would say that is God. It's got to be something outside the created universe. It can't just be some man says, I know, I think that'll call that right, I'll call this wrong. Why should anyone else pay any attention to him? It's got to be someone outside the system. It's got to be someone with the power to put the idea of right and wrong in the minds of all mankind, all creation. So someone who created us. That sounds very like God, doesn't it? Another consequence, we've got a creator then who is very, very interested in the difference between right and wrong. And a good God will do something about wrong. He can't just be indulgent and reward wickedness. A good God has to condemn wickedness, and the God of the Bible is exactly such a God. So the atheist God argument falls over because it assumes something about the character of God which is false. It actually also assumes something about the power of God which is false. God has restricted his own power. So you might say to the atheist, I don't believe in the God that you say doesn't exist. So, what does the Bible say about it? Well, if we go to Genesis chapter 1 and verse 31, you can see what the world was like when God finished making it. Genesis chapter 1 and the last verse of the chapter, verse 31. God saw everything that he'd made, and behold, it was very good, and there was evening and there was morning, the sixth day. So everything at that point was good. But God put mankind in the world, and mankind violated God's law of right and wrong, and going against God's law is termed sin in the Bible. Sin is what leads to death. Essentially, man, even though he knew God's moral standard, preferred to follow his own desires instead, and the consequence was death. And if you go to Romans chapter 5, and verse 12, you find that summarized. If you read Genesis 3, you get it in a whole chapter, but in Romans 5 and verse 12, you get it in a verse. So Romans chapter 5 and verse 12. And it says there, therefore, just as sin came into the world through one man, and death through sin, so death spread to all men because all have sinned. And it's referring initially, of course, to the incident where the first man violated God's law and was thus sentenced to death. And it goes on to point out that human beings have continued to violate God's law since, and so we all deserve death equally. I'd point out here that it's not an individual sin that leads to an individual death, unless, you know, if I do put strychnine in the president's water, then that sin would lead to his death. But in general, we die because we live in a world which is cursed as a result of the fact that we are sinners, not because any single sin that we do will cause our death. It's a principle that's found throughout the Bible. If you want to find an equivalent passage from the Old Testament, Ezekiel chapter 18 and verse 4. And this is God, the words of God. It says, behold, all souls are mine, the soul of the Father as well as the soul of the Son is mine, the soul who sins shall die. The soul means a living creature, not restricted necessarily to human beings, although there are not many other human creatures with a knowledge of right and wrong. But whatever it is, if it's alive and it sins, then it will die. And if you carry on down the page to verse 20 of the same chapter, it says, it starts off, the soul who sins shall die. Fairly simple statement of it. So, it's an important principle of the Bible. All sinners must die, and it's fairly easy to understand why sin has to lead to death. The alternative is a world full of immortal sinners. Now, if you imagine what your world would be like, a world full of people like Adolf Hitler, Genghis Khan, Pol Pot, Joseph Stalin, I expect you can probably think of others as well. All of them there, all of them lasting to eternity and able to continue to work their evil as long as they feel like it. And God has brought an end to that by bringing death. So because of man's wickedness, God brought the curse of death into the world, and with it, he brought suffering. Death might come through a natural disaster or through human negligence or direct human action or simply by old age, but it's still the greatest disaster. It's still the result of mankind's sin, and in the end it's mankind's freedom to choose wickedness that leads to suffering and death. So when I said there's random, apparently uncaused suffering, well, it's random. Not necessarily uncaused, because the cause of it is the fact we live in a world that's cursed by sin. And that's what leads to our death. So we've got the soul that sins, it shall die. In the meantime, suffering acts as a warning. Just as pain is a warning, there are people who, for one reason or another, don't feel pain. And those people are missing an important warning system. As a consequence, they tend to injure themselves without realizing it. Now, people who feel pain touch a hot object and they pull their hand back immediately because it hurts, and they get a minor burn. If you don't have pain, you put your hand on something hot, it stays there, and you end up with a badly burned hand instead. So pain tells us that there's something wrong with our circumstances. Suffering tells us that there is something wrong with the world. The point is that there is something wrong with the world. It's full of sin. But, of course, God doesn't intend that situation to continue forever. God promises that in the end evil won't prevail, and I want to look at two passages about that. The first is in the Revelation chapter 21. Revelation chapter 21 and verses 3 and 4. It's talking here about the ultimate end of creation, of existence, I suppose. He said, I heard a loud voice from the throne of God saying, behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God, and he will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain any more, for the former things have passed away. That's the intention of God. That's where the world is going to. And that's a theme that we find again throughout the Bible, Old Testament as well. Isaiah 35. And verse 5, just reading a very short bit, Isaiah 35 verse 5, it says, then shall the eyes of the blind be opened, and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then shall the lame man leap as a deer, and the tongue of the mute sing for joy. It's talking about a time when there is no more suffering going on. And at the bottom, verse 10, the ransomed of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with singing, and everlasting joy shall be upon their heads. They shall obtain gladness and joy, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away. And the purpose of God is that evil will be destroyed, that suffering will cease, the things that are wrong with the world as a result of mankind's sin will be put right, and there will be no more evil. And the period in which that happens, then, in the Bible, is the kingdom of God. It starts at the day of judgment, and it basically continues forever, though there's two phases to it. there afterwards. So the thing to remember when we look at the world is it's not in its final state. It's in the process of building something much better. If you take a look over the fence of the building site, then you see a mess of concrete, bricks and scaffolding, usually in the middle of a large muddy hole. Right? It doesn't look that good. And it's difficult to judge what the completed building will like by looking at the building site. And you can imagine someone, the equivalent of an atheist with buildings, looking over and saying, oh, no architects there, look at that, it's just a mess made of mud and bricks. It looks horrible. That isn't what it's going to be like forever, of course. In the end, the only thing you can do is look at the architect's plans and drawings. That's what you had was the Olympic, before the London Olympics, Olympic Arena. That's the architect's picture of what he thought it was going to look like. It didn't look like that in the previous slide, that's when they're building it. But it looked a lot better when it was finished, and it might not be quite as good as the architect's design, but it was still quite good. Of course, when God's doing the designing, it is going to look as good as God's design. It's not quite the same as human beings trying to do it. So it's an important thing to remember is that in the end, it's the long-term view that makes sense. It's only when you've got a view of the whole of eternity from creation to the kingdom of God that you've got a picture of what the world is really like. In the long term, our current sufferings are just an eye blink against the whole of eternity, and the eternity picture is one of peace and happiness in God's kingdom. In the meantime, we're building that. So having seen that, there are 4 points you can make about suffering. Oops, wrong way. So the first one is that suffering and death are not what our world is intended to be like. They're the consequence of sin, and the existence of death in particular puts a limit on the growth of human wickedness. Second point is that suffering can develop character, it can make you a better person. Now that sounds like a terribly hard thing to say, very, very hard to accept. Sit there thinking, and I was visiting my daughter in hospital yesterday. It's easy to sit there thinking, why can't God have a plan that doesn't involve her being in hospital? I can appreciate that problems of suffering without that. But it's a point that has scriptural backing. If you go to Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 5. He says there, have you forgotten the exhortation that addresses your sons? My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor be weary when reproved by him. For the Lord disciplines the one he loves and chastises every son who receives. It's for discipline that you have to endure. God is treating your sons. For what son is there who his father does not discipline? And he likens the pain of suffering to the chastisement that a child receives from its parents with the intention of teaching rather than causing needless suffering. And if you go down to verse 11, the point is repeated. It says, for the moment all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant, but later it yields the peaceful fruits of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. The third point, suffering is a short-term necessity to bring about an eternal kingdom of peace and justice where suffering is done away with. And again, that's got an explicit statement in the Bible, in the letter to the Romans, Romans chapter 8 and verse 18. Romans 8 verse 18, I consider the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed to us. For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subject to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now. It's likening the pains of suffering to the labour of childbirth, unpleasant but necessary to bring a new creation to light. And finally, suffering is a sign that there's something wrong with the world. We can see that sin has spoiled the world, and that there is something better to come. So we've thought about the problem of evil. Let's go on and think about the problem of justice. That could be summarised by the question, how can you believe in a just God when the innocent suffer at least as much as the guilty? And again, we have a problem of definition. In reality, no one's innocent. Everyone who's has broken God's universal moral principle. I've done it, you've done it, everyone's done it. Romans chapter 3 and verse 10. It says, as it is written, Romans 3 verse 10, as it is written, none is righteous, no, not one. And then there's a whole list of verses, which are most of which are quotations from the Old Testament, which show how badly mankind has gone astray from God. It ends up in verse 23, where it says, all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. So that's an important spiritual principle. We know it's true from personal experience. But some people are more wicked than others, and the wicked often appear to prosper. It says the rain it raineth on the just and also on the unjust fellow. It's not in the Bible, this is just a bit of poetry. The rain it raineth on the just and also on the unjust fellow, but mostly it rains on the just, for the unjust hath the just's umbrella. And again, if you want to make sense of that, you have to take the long view. Ecclesiastes chapter 3, we read the whole of the chapter, well, not the whole of the chapter, but a large chunk of the chapter while we were getting ready for the meeting, as it were, the first part of the meeting, the reading. The point about this is, it's a list of places where there's a time for one thing and then a time for something else. He gives a whole set of examples and draws from that sometimes there's a time for one thing, sometimes there's a time for something else. So Ecclesiastes chapter 3 verse 60 says, moreover I saw under the sun that in the place of justice even there was wickedness, and the place of righteousness even there was wickedness. And I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time for every matter and for every work. He's pointing out that now's the time when injustice is going to rule, but there's a time for one thing sometimes and a time for something else at another time. The time for justice, he says, is coming in the end. And of course we talk about the day of judgment, and that's when justice really will come, and fortunately also mercy, because if it was just justice we would be in trouble. Gone a bit further on, the same point appears again in chapter 8 of Ecclesiastes, and verse 12. It says, though a sinner does evil 100 times and prolongs his life, yet I know that it will be well with those who fear God because they fear before him. But it won't be well with the wicked, neither will he prolong his days like a shadow because he does not fear before God. The point is that we might be oppressed by injustice now in what we suffer, but there's a time coming when that will be sorted out by God. And again, we can jump to the wrong conclusion. We just take a short-term view. We can only think about the next year, quite possibly, injustice will carry on like it is now. And if you think about the whole of eternity, for most of that time, justice is what's going to rule. And those who are unjust now will receive problems at that point. So, that brings on to the personal problem. There we go. Personal problem is, I'm suffering. So, what should I believe? What should I do? Moving from a theoretical discussion to problems that are more personal. If you are in pain in hospital, if you find your child has an incurable disease, then the answer, you're suffering because sin curses the world, may be true, but it's probably not very comforting. An emotionally more satisfying answer may come in the example of Jesus Christ. Jesus was very much better than any of us. He never broke God's moral standard. He never committed sin. If anyone deserved not to suffer, it was Jesus. But in spite of that, he did suffer, particularly agonizing death on a cross, one which will probably be far more agonizing than anything any of us has to suffer. And we have to ask ourselves, do we deserve less than that? David the king had to face that problem. In Psalm 73, he talks about it. Let's have a little look at that. Psalm 73 and verse 3. And David saw the wicked prosper. Psalm 73 verse 3 says, I was envious of the arrogant when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. Rouses envy. The wicked are prospering, the good are not. Verse 12 goes on, he talks about that for a bit, about how the wicked are still doing quite well. And then he comes to verse 12, he says, behold, these are the wicked, always at ease. They increase in riches, summarizes it all. The ungodly prosper while the faithful suffer. Verse 16, when I thought how to understand this, it seemed to me a wearisome task. David considers that it's too much for him to bear almost. But in verse 17, until, he says, I went into the sanctuary of God, then I discerned their ends. He started to consider the wicked against God's plan. And verses 18 and 19, truly you set them in slippery places, you make them fall to ruin. How they are destroyed in a moment, swept away utterly by terrors. He knew that judgment in the end would overtake the wicked. It's only the long view, remember, that matters. Those who are facing suffering face a very vital problem. That could be stated, I'm suffering, what shall I do? And some people give in at that point. Actually, they don't usually, but people encourage them to it. They try and get back at God. The only thing they can do is to refuse to believe in him. But it's no use. For what little satisfaction refusal to believe in God gives, you still have to face the suffering. But if you turn your back on God, then you have to face it on your own, instead of facing it with God. And the way to overcome suffering is by service to God, by faith, by following God's way. And that way the suffering becomes less destructive, it becomes more of a refining process for us. And in the end, we're led to God's kingdom, and the suffering is gone away. So let's summarise what we've seen. First of all, the picture of the world given in the Bible is that God made it good, it made it free of suffering, made it without death, and mankind ruined that situation by violating God's law, and hence brought the world to a state which contains suffering and pain and death. Not only that, but we continue to exercise our free will and to violate God's universal moral principle. And so suffering continues. But there's good news. The world we live in now isn't the end of the story. God is using it to build a better world, a world without suffering, which is inhabited by the faithful. And you have an opportunity to have your failures forgiven and to be raised up to this world. Let's go back to the atheist argument. Remember the atheists problem about suffering. The interesting thing is that the existence of that argument tells us something. The atheists are arguing that it is wrong to allow suffering, which means that there must be a moral principle to say what's right and what's wrong. And the question then is, where does that moral principle come from? It has to come from someone outside the system. It has to come from someone eternal who put the idea into the creation. So it only makes sense if there is a God to underwrite the difference between right and wrong. So the fact that the atheist can make that argument is only useful if there is a God who exists. If there is no God, that argument is meaningless. So when an atheist makes that argument, they're producing evidence for the existence of God. That's something that quite often they haven't realised. So the point there is that God is making a world without suffering, and if we want to be part of that world, we have to investigate that God. Thank you.